as Kevin said, my name is Kristen. I'm Kristen Farrell. I am on the leadership team here at Watermark Wesleyan as a board member and vice chair of the board, and I'm also part of the preaching team. And so today we're going to talk about look what I found. Well, look what I found. Do you know what this is? Anybody know what this is? What is this? It's a K-cup. Does anybody know the guy who invented it? Probably not, right? John Sylvan is the guy who invented K-cups. And K-cups, believe it or not, have been around since 1999. They've been an incredible discovery that have been able to give people soft, you know, fast, quick doses of their morning caffeine and coffee quicker than you could ever imagine. And it's been an incredible discovery, but it's come with some great responsibility. In fact, some of you might not have known this, but a few years ago, there were 8.3 billion K-cups that were consumed, which is a pretty astronomical number. So much so that the waste from the 8.3 billion K-cups that were used could circle the world 10 times, could circle the Earth 10 times. And that was a few years ago. The latest count for 2018, where there were 9.8 billion K-cups produced. John Sylvan, the guy who discovered these, said that it has become an environmental catastrophe. And he, because of that, has stepped down. Now, I'm not trying to make everybody feel bad for their K-cup consumption, but it's a thing. With an incredible discovery comes some great responsibility. They're thinking that maybe they'll be recyclable by 2020, but John Sylvan says no matter what they say about recycling, those things will never be recyclable. In fact, he stepped down from the company and said, I feel bad sometimes that I ever did it. K-cups. The incredible discovery of K-cups. That's a negative way. So let's think about another incredible discovery. This one dates back to 1861. And you may not have known that this was a pivotal day in your life even before you're born. Some of you are like, I'm not that old. None of us are that old. But it was an incredible discovery in 1861. My kids are still influenced by this incredible discovery because when I get them off the bus and they run into the house, the first thing that I say is, have you washed your hands? Because in 1861, Louis Pasteur discovered that diseases were spread, infections were spread by pathogens. What we know is germs, bacteria. Up until then, people, scientists, doctors, they thought that diseases and colds and things were spread through spontaneous generation, almost like the Big Bang theory of germs, but they didn't think germs happened, that it was just some cosmic thing that we got sick. But no, it was Louis Pasteur who said, no, these are germs, we spread them. And so because of his incredible discovery that he shared with the world, literally tens of thousands of people's lives have been saved as a result of that incredible discovery. Before that, people would get a cold, they could die. And now we don't have to suffer that, even though I am still suffering a cold. But that incredible discovery impacted people in amazing ways. And we're gonna go back even further to another incredible discovery. This one happened in 850 BC. And this is, we're going to look at a time in 2 Kings where Israel was kind of a mess. Israel was a nation that was split into the north and the south. The north was called Israel, the south was called Judah. And Israel was led by a series of horrible kings. Kings that one after the other just encouraged idol worship and paganism and one bad decision after the next. And these kings were pulling Israelites further and further away from God. And no matter what God seemed to do to try to shake them up, these kings just didn't get it. And this is where we find ourselves. The current king was King Jehoram, and he just wasn't getting it. In fact, there was a prophet named Elisha, and he kept trying to get through to the king, saying, listen, all these bad things are going to happen unless you turn to the Lord. But the king was stubborn time and time and time again. So stubborn that the city that he was in charge of, Samaria, became under siege. Elijah had said, the Aramaeans are going to come and they're going to take over your city if you don't turn toward God. And still the king said, no dice, I'm not doing it. That's not the Lord that I serve. And sure enough, the Arameans came in, surrounded Samaria, and they besieged the city. And what that meant is that they essentially trapped the city. They left the city with nothing coming in or out of the city. And so it was a pretty dark time for Samaria under this Aramean control. And if you think about it, I don't know how you guys feel about garbage day, but when I take the garbage, actually I don't take the garbage, when my husband takes the garbage out, I think, thank God for garbage day. Can you imagine if the garbage day didn't come for a month? We would just have trash piled up everywhere. I think about that in Samaria. Nothing's coming in or out. So there just must have been trash everywhere. And not only that, if things aren't coming in or out, do you know what else isn't coming in or out? Food. So this was a really dark time for Samaria, a time that was noted most by its famine. And this wasn't just a few days. This isn't like I'm a little bit hungry. This is years and years of famine. So much where all the laws that they had followed were just out the window. Clean, unclean meats or foods, it didn't matter. In fact, they were chopping off donkeys' heads and selling donkeys' heads to eat. There were tiny little grains that would sell for exorbitant prices because the famine was so bad. If you think that's bad, it gets even worse. In 2 Kings chapter 6, there's this horrible story about two moms. They obviously needed the women's retreat. Two moms got together and said, we're so hungry. Today, let's eat your son, and tomorrow we'll eat my son. I mean, so when I tell you famine, this is cannibalism kind of famine. It was a very, very dark time in Samaria. And there was no hope. There was no hope in store for this. How would the siege break? When would the famine stop? Over and over and over again, day after day after day, conditions just kept getting worse, and the king was helpless to do anything. Well, Elijah comes back, and he tells the king, King, I tell you that I have been told from the Lord the famine will end tomorrow, and food prices will go back to normal. I mean, this was shocking news. How in the world could it end just like that? It would be like saying, everyone, tomorrow's going to be 83 and sunny, which maybe in Buffalo it would, right? Who knows with our weather? But it's this idea that something so drastic would happen so quickly, it seemed completely unlikely. And again, did the king listen to Elijah's words from the Lord? Absolutely not. And that brings us to this point in the story where we're going to look at four lepers who were outside the city gates. I feel like I'm starting like a bad joke. Four lepers walk into a bar. But no, it's four lepers at the city gates. And you can imagine that if times were tough for the Samaritans, imagine how bad it was for the lepers. I mean, they're the lowest of the low. They're already outcasts. They're already treated poorly. They're already sick with disease. And then it's famine on top of that. So you would think that maybe people would have a little generosity to throw them a few crumbs here and there, that that would not be happening. So we're talking the desperate of the desperate, the most needy, the most affected by this famine. In fact, they're not even inside the city gates. It was worse outside the city gates where there was absolutely nothing but desolation. And that's where we meet the lepers. And we kind of hear a little bit of their conversation as they are on death's doorstep right here, deciding what they should do to try to better their cause. In 2 Kings 7, 3 through 4, it says, now there were four men with leprosy at the entrance of the city gate. They said to each other, why stay here until we die? If we say, we'll go into the city, the famine is there, and we will die. And if we stay here, we will die. So let's go over to the camp of the Arameans and surrender. If they spare us, we live. If they kill us, then we die. So it's not looking good here. It's like our options are we could die, we could die, we could die, or we could surrender and probably die. It feels like an old Monty Python skit, those of you who remember that, right? Those are our options, death, 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 and probable death. So what do they have to lose? They have nothing to lose. So they make their way to the camp of the Arameans. And when we say camp of the Arameans, this is probably like the size of a large college campus. When I think camp, I think, you know, five people in a tent. But that's not how these camps were. So the city was besieged, and the Arameans were outside of the city gates in their own luxurious camp. It's like they're glamping. Let's say that. So at dusk, they got up and went to the camp of the Arameans. When they reached the edge of the camp, no one was there. For the Lord had caused the Arameans to hear the sound of chariots and horses and a great army, so that they said to one another, "Look, the king of Israel has hired the Hittite and the Egyptian kings to attack us." So they got up and fled in the dusk and abandoned their tents and their horses and their donkeys and their food and their drinks and their gold and their silver. And they left camp as it was and ran for their lives. Crazy story. They're all just hanging out at camp. All is well. There's no way the Samaritans are going to come. They should be safe. And then they hear something, like a wind, enough that they're so terrified and so threatened that they just say, "Let's get out of here." I mean, they take off. They don't stop to collect their photo books, right? They leave everything as it was, which is phenomenal because who's on their way there? The lepers. So the lepers come to this camp, and there's no enemy there, but there's food, and there's gold, and there's silver, and there's drink. I mean, talk about the land of milk and honey. These lepers have arrived, and they act as much. These are happy lepers. Instead of happy camper shirts, you could have happy leper camp shirts. They're eating, and they're drinking, and they're taking the gold, and they're taking the silver, and they've just about died and gone to heaven. It says, the men who had leprosy reached the edge of the camp, entered one of the tents, and ate and drank. Then they took silver, gold, and clothes, and went off and hid them. They're smart, right? They're investing in their future. Not only are we going to gorge ourselves now, but we're also going to make sure we ensure our future. They're smart lepers. Then they returned and entered another tent and took some things from it and hid them also. So they just keep kind of plundering the camp. Here they go. They have so many resources. So they do this repeatedly. And I can't imagine four guys amidst this giant camp. I mean, they have it made. Why would they do anything but just continue to live in the glory of what they found, right? There's no reason to go back. No families, no relatives, no people they feel obligated to. And yet, after the alcohol wears off, after they're feeling a little bloated, they start thinking about the situation in a big picture kind of a way. And it just doesn't sit well with them, right? They start developing a conscience, actually. So you think, you know, maybe their immediate response would go back and share. It wouldn't be for me. I'm not that kind. I need to work on it. You can pray for me, right? I would be like, forget them. They treated us like outcasts. We were outcasts. We had nothing. But like I said, something changed in them. They knew better. And it says this. Then they said to each other, "What we're doing is not right. This is a day of good news, and we are keeping it to ourselves. If we wait until daylight, punishment will overtake us. Let's go at once and report this to the royal palace. Because with great discovery comes great responsibility." And they know that, and they feel that. And if we look at that scripture, we can tease out three observations that I think are really interesting. It's almost like scaffolding of their reasoning. And it doesn't say which leper said what, but I think maybe they kind of collaborated and said, hey, if we stop and think about this, there's three good reasons why we need to go back to the city. The first one is this. What we're doing is not right. And don't you, like, have a sense of that? Like, I really believe we're all born with a sense of what's right and what's wrong. We know when we're doing something that's a little bit off or a lot off. And it's hard to argue when people are suffering a famine and other people are gorging themselves, literally gorging themselves, that that's just not right. And they recognize that. I teach high school English, and I bought a book actually when I was doing youth ministry probably 15 years ago, and it's a Would You Rather book. It has all these scenarios, and there's one scenario that's so horrible. It says, would you rather break a child's confidence or eat a cheeseburger in front of a starving child? And my students are like, that's horrible. Nobody, would you rather? Like, I would rather none of those things. Because you know that when there's a famine, you shouldn't be gorging yourselves when other people are suffering that way. The second thing is they said, this is good news. We have good news and we should share it, right? That there's something in us that when something is good, that we feel compelled to be able to share that good news. And the third one is they fear punishment. And in scripture, punishment and fear is kind of used in two different ways. One, literally like the wrath of God punishment, afraid in that kind of way. But then there's also fear of the Lord in a way that comes with reverence and awe. And so it's interesting, when I was doing research for this, when it says that they worry that punishment will overtake them, I thought, who are they worried about punishment from? Because if you think about it, they're not worried about punishment from the Samaritans. They've already been outcasted. They've already been punished because they don't fit in with society. They come to the Arameans. They clearly weren't, you know, they've given up on being worried about punishment there because they knew that if they surrender, they could die. So who is it that they're worried about punishment from? Well, from the Lord. Not only do they know it's right and wrong, they know that they should share the good things that they've had, but they want to obey God. They knew God, and they knew that this is not the way God would want them to deal with their great discovery. So for those three reasons, they go back. They go back, they tell the gatekeepers, and there's a great commotion. Could this really be true? The king was sleeping. He wakes up. You think the king believes it? No, they were very hard-headed kings. And he says, I still don't believe it. And then the one lieutenant sticks up for himself, and he says, can we at least just check this out? I mean, what do we have to lose, right? We're already in a horrible state of things. So the long story short, that again you can read, says the lieutenant went, they sent some guys there, and they found out that what happened was true, that there was this empty camp just full of resources to be enjoyed. And that's what it says in Kings 2:7, verse 16. Then the people went out and plundered the camp of the Arameans. They got everything they needed. So a sea of the finest flour sold for a shekel, and two seas of barley sold for a shekel, as the Lord had said. Now that whole selling for a shekel, what does that mean? Well, that just means that exactly what Elisha had predicted came true, right? That the economy was back to a fair price. And it happened like that, because now there were resources, the prices of food could come down. So a great prediction, completely fulfilled, testifying to what Elisha had been saying about the Lord. So this is a great end of the story, right? Yahoo, victory for God, everybody's great. So what's the point? What's the point of all this? And hopefully you're starting to understand, right? That the idea is that obviously it's the lepers who saved the day. They're the heroes of the story because they did the right thing. God used the lepers just as much as Elijah, God's chosen one, to show God's glory and God's provision. That's pretty exciting stuff. But this is 2019, right? Where are the lepers in Eden, in Angola, and Derby, and Hamburg? You know where they are? They're right here. They're sitting right here. You are the lepers. I am the leper. Why? Because do you remember when you were so hungry? Do you remember when you were so desperate? Do you remember when you were starving for a different way of life? For something that would give you hope? For something that you could feast on that was real and tangible and satisfying and filled with contentment? Do you remember when you were the leper outside the city gate? And now, because you've committed to come here to this place, something tells me that you have made an incredible discovery. You have made the incredible discovery of the presence of Jesus. But with an incredible discovery comes great responsibility. And I'm not naive to think that everybody here in this room, you know, are Christ followers and 100% sold out. And that's okay. I hope that you're not feeling the devastation and the starvation of what the Samaritans were feeling in that city. But if you are, you're in the right place, because we're a bunch of lepers who know that there's a different way. And I hope that coming here, you get a taste of that, that you get a taste of that. But you lepers who are outside of the city gates, I want you to remember. I want you to remember that desperation that you felt. You know, we take communion and it says, do this and remember. Because I'll be honest, it's so easy to forget sometimes. It's so easy to go through the dailiness and to not think that our faith in the goodness of Jesus is not an incredible discovery, which it is. So I want you to take a moment just to think back. Think back to that time when it did feel like an incredible discovery. I remember for me, I was a teenager, and since then I've had lots of new discoveries, right? It says God's mercies are new every morning, because I certainly couldn't ride out one moment when I was 15 and get through, you know, to my 42nd year and still have one moment. God, I think, gives us these moments to help us remember all the time. But that first moment, I was at a place called Camp of the Woods, and I was on staff there, and it was like a staff retreat night. And it was a moment where it was quiet. We still had overhead projectors with those films. And so there was like that film that they put up, and it was all blotchy, but it was a song. I don't even know what song it was. But I remember that the leader said, if you feel comfortable, just get down on your knees. Just get down on your knees and close your eyes. And just humble your heart in surrender. And I have to tell you, the wave of love that just overcame me is something that I can still feel all these years later. In that moment was just a buildup of different relationships that I had and different scriptures I had heard and different sermons I'd been a part of and other moments of worship. So it was a cumulative effect. It was a night and day for me. It took me a long time. I had to hear about the Lord so many times before I knew it. Right, I had known it, but this was when I knew it. And when you think back to that moment of discovery, you can't help but want to share it. I mean, that's the whole point. If we don't, we're missing a huge part of why we even know Christ to begin with. And so if you think about those three reasons, those three observations from the lepers, and put them into your life. And what if you really embraced those, right? The first one, this is just not right. You guys, the world is starving. Don't you see that? Don't you see that every day at work and on the news and in your neighborhoods? The world is dying of starvation. They need spiritual food. They need hope. They need light. There's a lot of darkness out there. And we're here on a Sunday gorging ourselves in worship, in goodness, in teaching, and relationships. And what are you going to do with that? Right? It's just not right for you to be feasting on the goodness of God's presence while there are people starving out there, starving, looking for something better. I hope you know that it is a necessity, that there's a right and a wrong thing to do. And the right thing is to share what you know so that others can be feasting in the way that we can. And believe me, I'm not saying this in a trite way that is easy. It is not an easy thing, and it is a long process. But I hope that those are the eyes you use when you're looking at your community and the people who are around you, and you see them starving. The other thing is, right, they want to share the good news. I know that social media is controversial, and there's a lot of bad things about social media. What I love about social media is babies. My kids aren't babies anymore, and I'm getting great joy in that. But man, I love going to social media and seeing some people post pictures of their babies. I have an old student. Her name is Kellen. I had her homeroom for four years and, walked her through some of those horrible high school years. Now she posts pictures of her fat twins. They're so stinking cute. Like, I love just going online just to see those fat twins, you know. Or, like, I love food. Most of the meals that I make are meh, but when I make a good one, I love posting it, being like, look at this beautiful food that I ate. You know, I want to share my good news. Or if I get an opportunity to go on a date with my husband, gosh, when marriages are crumbling around us at 50%, right, that's the divorce rate, I like sharing my good news, posting a picture of me and Jeff and saying, hey, it's hard, but we're doing it. Our marriage is surviving. That's good news. I love social media. Kevin, if you know Kevin, he loves social media. He posts good news every 2 days. You're probably posting good news right now, Kevin, right? You've got your phone in your hand. I see you.
Taking notes.
Yeah, taking notes. I'll look at his Instagram, and it'll be like, posted 11:50 a.m. Be like, I went to the Sabres game with Isaac. Did you see that one? That was his latest good news, right? It's good news. We want to share good news. Do you ever have a moment? I go to work so stinking early in the morning, and I'm all grumpy about it. And then every once in a while, there will be a sunrise that is just so beautiful that I just want to stop driving down Newton Road. And it's over a farm, and it's so gorgeous, and it's so beautiful. But then I have this moment of sadness because I'm alone, and I have nobody to share it with. And sometimes really amazing, beautiful discoveries when you can't share your good news, they're just not quite as beautiful or quite as wonderful. We are made to share the good news that we have, and I hope you'll do that. And the last reason is that idea of just punishment, of obeying God. And again, I know punishment is a tricky thing in churches and scripture and guilt and all that other kind of stuff, but there's healthy ways to fear punishment. I hope my kids fear my punishment in a good, healthy way. Last week, we had to have a real long conversation because you want to know what the best way to solve a problem was in my household? Punch someone in the stomach, right? That was like their conflict management skills. You just punch someone in the stomach. I have twin boys. They're six. They're right over there. They probably feel horrible that I'm saying this. But they were punished because of that. It is not my plan for their lives for them to deal with conflict as they get older by punching people in their stomachs, right? So they had punishment because of that. We took away privileges, not because I'm a mean, wrathful, vengeful mom, but because I love them so much, because I want them to obey me because I know better for their lives right now, and I want them to experience goodness. And so if they're a little afraid of me in a good, healthy, respectful way, then I think that's a good thing. And God tells us, he has commandments for us that include love one another. What's the best way to love somebody? Sharing with them the good news that we have. We are called to do it. And I'll tell you, this is not easy. I said it already. This takes a long time to do. And I have to tell you that when I was in my early 20s and I was having those beautiful moments of wanting to share all of what I knew, I did some damage. I know I did some damage for the kingdom because I didn't have relationships with people and I wanted to just tell them how wrong they were because their life would be so much better with Christ. I'll give you a secret. That doesn't go over very well. Right? Shooting Bible verses to people who don't believe in the Bible to begin with, that's not super helpful. Do you know what's always helpful? Love, compassion, humility, kindness. These aren't my ideas, right? These are scriptural ideas. This is the message of Christ. That takes a long time. That takes a lot of relationship building. And so if it's going to take a long time, let's get started, right? Let's get started now. So I just want to ask you four questions to be thinking about this. Who will you be praying for? That's such a easy, it's so crazy that it just leaves us because it's so easy to do. And I just think the kingdom effects that it has is amazing. And this is a way to just like dip your toe in the water, right? Who am I going to be praying for? To tell you, I'm an English teacher, and part of the three worst hours of my school year was exam day. Because it's like watching paint dry, watching 425 freshmen write an essay for 2 hours. And I would just have to stand there and just stare at them. It was the most boring thing I ever did until I started praying for my students one by one during that exam time. I look forward to exam time now because I have a quiet moment to look at each one of my kids. And I don't pray that they do well on the exam. Who cares about commas? Don't tell them I said that. But I don't pray for that. I pray that they get to experience Christ and they get to know God's love in a way that will forever change their lives. I pray for them that they will have an incredible discovery of what it means to be loved and valued and be used to do amazing things for God's kingdom. Especially the students I don't like, I pray for even harder, right? I like all my students. Right, that's what we need to do. Remember, the people in Samaria didn't deserve at all the words and the goodness from the lepers. They didn't deserve it. But it didn't matter. So who could you be praying for? Who could you be praying for? Maybe it is an enemy. Maybe it's someone that you deeply love and care for. But I would challenge you today to just ask yourself, who is it that I could pray for? The next, who will I contact? Man, I think one of the best ways to know and to display the love of the Lord is to contact somebody with a message of forgiveness. I'm telling you, those bad choices I made in my 20s, early 20s, about really shoving Jesus in people's faces, I had to go back and apologize for some of that. Man, I'm sorry. I must have come across really judgy. I didn't mean to do that. I was just excited, and I didn't know kind of where to, you know, how to share my excitement. You know who I had to do that to with, surprisingly, the most? My sister. I was swept up in youth ministry, and I remember we had gone to New York City where she lived at the time. I was, you know, 22 and still, like, living with my parents, and we had gone to her house for Thanksgiving weekend, and she was, I mean, I didn't really know this at the time, but she was just devastatingly lonely, trying to, like, make it in the city, and we were there for the weekend, and Sunday morning I woke up, and I was like, hey, can we leave, because I have youth group at 6, and I just want to make sure I get back for youth group. And I didn't know that she was so sad about that because she just felt like, man, you love all these teenagers, but what about me? Like, I want you to stick around for a little bit longer. And I remember having to go back and say, Beth, man, I was so blinded by an excitement for ministry and evangelism that I lost sight of how I could love you well. So who can you contact today? Who can you reach out to? And maybe it's not a message of forgiveness. Maybe it's an old friendship that you just kind of haven't picked up with in a long time. And that's it. And again, when I say contact, I'm not saying contact and read him John 3:16. I'm saying just contact, just as a token of love and kindness and reaching out for the sake of connectivity in an ever disconnected world. And you want to go a little deeper? Who can you have a meal with? Buffalo is starting to become one of the like most foodie towns in the world. There's so many places to go out and eat. Maybe it's time where you just made some face-to-face contact with, and you can share your faith in a real way, not in a, like, you need Jesus kind of a way, but in a, like, this is how I find hope. This is what I'm seeing. This is what's really hard about my faith. Do you know that most people, they don't need to hear how, like, Jesus comes in and makes everything happy. It's okay if you share the hard things that you're wrestling with, and how you know that Jesus is your hope in those moments. And that you still have faith that things will turn out for good. That's an amazing testimony. It doesn't have to be a neat, beautiful little package of how amazing God is. You guys know that that's a that's not that God's not amazing, but that our lives are beautiful packages. We're all a mess. So maybe it's the story of your mess that will help people understand the goodness as you share with them your great discovery with a meal. And then maybe, and again, I hope you realize how these are scaffolded, right? That we don't expect you to start handing out pamphlets on the street and just inviting people. But the last one is, who can I invite? Who can I invite into God's presence? Who can I invite into understanding what it means to have a relationship with Jesus? That's a powerful invitation. Who can I invite here? I love being here. This is such like a chill, laid back place to just hang out and learn about God. I don't feel any weird, pretentious, like we're so amazing kind of thing that is so often in some other churches. That's like one of the beauty of South Creek. I love being here because of that. Who can you invite to this church? I'm going to do a shameless plug for our Easter series because we're working on it, and it's incredible. We're going to spend 7 weeks before Easter, and the series title is The Week That Changed the World. And each day, we're going to look at what Jesus experienced that day so that we can understand what it means to have him both impact our lives but also how he impacted the world. What a great way to come and say, you know what, you know me, I'm not so good with the words thing. Why don't you come to my church and hear about Jesus that way? You know, we'll get a cup of coffee afterward and, you know, no pressure. But who can you invite to that series that is starving, that is hungry, that needs spiritual food in a way that we know only Jesus can provide? You know, it's the week that changed everything, but I think you'll probably agree that the thing that he changed most was you, and how beautiful that is. When I think about how much the lepers were probably changed by that, and how that whole story just comes full circle, knowing God's goodness and God's provision in that. You know, we don't do it just because, you know, it's an Old Testament thing, but we do it because I hope you understand Jesus did it first, right? In 1 John, as we wrap up, it says, "This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only son into the world that we might live through him." Every time I think of that verse, I think of that weird Sixth Sense movie where that like a creepy kid walked around and said, "I see dead people," right? Like, I look around the world and I see dead people, just spiritually dead people doing the daily grind, going 9 to 5, right? Time to make the donuts, paycheck to paycheck, without much hope, without much joy, without much love. And we have something that says you can live, really live through him. This is love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. So where is God sending you? Where are you in the line of the city gates? If you're feasting, what are you doing with that incredible discovery? I hope you understand that with that discovery comes great responsibility. Let's pray. God, thank you for the ways that you help us feast in the midst of a starving culture, that all around us, Lord, that people are experiencing starvation, and yet we can live our lives content and full and good and peaceful and hopeful. Not every day, God, not knowing that we don't experience suffering and frustration and everything else, Lord, but amidst all that pain and suffering, that we have a hope. We have a goodness and a faith that sets us free. And God, I pray that as we remember those moments of what it feels like to be in your presence, Lord, that we will not take those moments for granted, and that we will not hoard them and hide them away for later use, but Lord, that we will share them, that we will see a hurting world, and we will know that we have what they need to be fulfilled and to have hope. God, I pray that you embolden us, but with love and with humility, as we go and we share this good news with the world around us.